critically analyzing national affairs. This is State of the Nation with Timothy Shea and Brian McClain on today's News Talk.
TNT.
All right, rolling into hour two, State of the Nation here. I'm Brian McClain. I'm here with Timothy Shea for today's News Talk. TNTradio.live is our website. Get on over there and join the mosh pit over there. We have an interactive live chat room, so get on in there. Throw some elbows, some links, and some love. We'd love to see you over there. And thank you to you over there being in there in the chat room. We appreciate you being there. Now, that was a bit of a special segment, Timothy. We went extra long on that one. We even kicked a break out of there. So thank you in the studio for letting us do that. That's a really big story. And that is told in a way that you're just not going to find in the mass media cartel.
You're definitely not. And Dr. Martinelli did a great job of laying it all out, talking about, you know, you're facing east now and they were heading south. The whole story just sounds rather odd. Why would illegals with backpacks, large backpacks, all of a sudden be heading south? Well, if one of their party had killed someone, they'd want to scoot back over the border to avoid the jurisdiction. None of the facts in the case make any sense. They don't hang together, Brian. There's no narrative that is being put on Mr. Kelly that will hang together. I'm hoping that the jury sees it that way.
I don't see how they can't. I mean, it feels like a slam dunk for the defense in this case. And I really hope that we have some honest brokers on that jury. I don't see how we can't. And some of the comments made by the sheriff in this video, we didn't really get to brush on this too much, but if you're out there and you're interested in learning more about this, I recommend looking up this video. It's called Sheriff Serving and Living on US/Mexico Border, Tour Both Sides. There's some really strange comments made by the sheriff over there in Santa Cruz County, Arizona. He mentions the rancher who, quote, wanted to kill Mexicans, end quote, as he drove through Mr. Kelly's ranch neighborhood. That is a strange thing to say. He also referred to Border Patrol and law enforcement as Gestapo, quote unquote. And he also in there around the 26-minute mark, he minimizes border crimes like cartel murders, robberies, and rapes, and jokes about rape trees and terrorists coming across the border and says it's all sensationalism. That's in a video created by Fox. You can find that up there to sort of get some insight into the mindset of the law enforcement in this county. And it's a little disturbing, Timothy.
It is disturbing. And, you know, one of my skills is being able occasionally to peer around corners. And so let me do that right now. There's something in the law called a judgment non abstante verdicto, which is the judge saying that overruling a jury's determination, saying that no reasonable jury could have arrived at the conclusion to which the jury arrived. Now, this could cut both positively and negatively. If a jury in New York acquits Donald Trump, you could theoretically have Judge Marchand, who's proven to be thoroughly corrupt, declaring, because it's a criminal trial, that no reasonable jury could have found Donald Trump innocent, and actually declaring him to be guilty and putting him in jail pending appeal. That's one way it could cut. Another way is, in this case, if the jury were to find Mr. Kelly guilty here and none of the facts align with the prosecution's theory of the case, if you had a judge that did have integrity and was an honest broker, he might very well conclude that no reasonable jury could have found Mr. Kelly guilty. So it'll be interesting in both cases to see whether we have that extremely rarely used mechanism, judgment non abstante verdicto.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll be excited to have Dr. Martinelli back on to give us an update.
Yeah.
I really think that that Mr. Kelly's going to get acquitted here. He absolutely should. And I think it's bound to happen. If not, something is very, very wrong. And Timothy, let me get this one in here, too. We might go a couple minutes over, but this is important. Supreme Court cast doubt on obstruction charges against hundreds of January 6 rioters. This is pretty big. Out of Washington, the Supreme Court today, they're casting their doubt on the legality of these obstruction charges, and these have been lodged against some 300, quote unquote, rioters from January 6th. And what's going on here is the court's conservatives questioned whether the 2002 Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which was aimed at corporate accounting fraud, can be used more broadly to prosecute those who obstruct any official proceeding, including Congress's 2021 certification of President Biden. So we've got Chief Justice John G. Roberts Jr. and Justice Gorsuch noted that the law made it a crime to destroy or conceal documents to impair an official proceeding, but they voiced doubt over extending it to any disruptions of a proceeding. So, you know, this is pretty interesting. They asked some good questions there.
Yeah, let me keep this quick. Here's what's going on. The law in question, Sarbanes-Oxley, has a clause that has criminal penalties if you destroy evidence, right? So shredding documents is the classic case that people think of. And the second clause, and the idea is shredding documents to impede an official proceeding. The second clause says, or otherwise conspiring or acting to obstruct or impede an official proceeding. And what the government is trying to do is have that secondary clause, which is a catch-all, in case they're not destroying documents, they did something else that was akin to that. Again, we're talking in the context of accounting fraud, of corporate fraud, white-collar crime. They're trying to get that to be a standalone provision that should be read on its face, when that's not what the law is. The law is, when you have a catch-all provision like that, you have to read it in the context of the preceding language. And clearly, that places this entire case outside of Sarbanes-Oxley. And that's what the conservative majority was questioning today. What I loved was Justice Gorsuch's recitation of a variety of scenarios that could lead to criminal prosecution, Brian. And one of them was, would pulling a fire alarm to delay a vote constitute obstructing an official proceeding? Which, of course, was a shot across the bow of Democrat Representative Jamal Bowman.
It absolutely was. I appreciated that also. It's a good read. Hey, for a complete list of shows and our schedule offered at TNT, simply visit our website, tntradio.live, where we serve up the latest live news and current affairs presented by a host of credible and expert commentators right here on today's News Talk, TNT.
Your voice heard here.
The government needs to step up and do its job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, Tim Murtaugh is the former communications director for Trump's 2020 campaign, also the founder and principal of Line Drive Public Affairs, the host of Line Drive Podcast, and a columnist at the Washington Times. Tim joins us to discuss his book, Swing Hard in Case You Hit, My Escape from Addiction and Shot at Redemption on the Trump Campaign. Tim, welcome to State of the Nation. Thanks for joining us today.
Very much for having me. Boy, you say it all together like that, it sounds like I'm pretty busy, I guess.
Well, you're obviously a busy man. Yeah.
So tell us about the thank you for having me.
Tell us about the book, you know, because I was watching you speak this morning while I was doing some prep for the show. I know that you have a lot of personal experience, and that's where the book comes from. It's a story, it's your personal story. So launch us into it for anyone who may not be familiar.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about this. Swing Hard in Case You Hit It, My Escape from Addiction and Shot at Redemption on the Trump Campaign. This is the book that I'd just came out with. It was published on April 2nd by Post Hill Press, of Bombardier Books of Post Hill Press, and distributed by Simon & Schuster. So I'm very grateful to them. And it's not like any political book that I think that you or your audience has ever read, really. It's got politics in it, sure. And a lot of that is from the Trump 2020 campaign. But it's also about my decades-long struggle to rid myself of the addiction of alcohol. And it took an awfully long time to do that. I was a really desperate, low-end alcoholic who was really facing really the end of the line if I didn't get myself straightened out. And so I've been to rehab five times. Five times I went and for alcohol treatment. And every time I was in there, I spent a lot of time in the bookstore, and I gravitated towards the titles that were written by people who were telling their own stories. I like those so much better than the more clinical medical textbook-like things that told you about the biology of addiction and all that. And that's important. But I like the stories, and those books really helped me. And I decided that if I ever wrote a book, that's what I wanted to write, because, you know, I would run out of those stories and I always wanted more. And I thought that if I could write a book, and if somebody who is struggling with addiction picks it up and flips through it just for 10 minutes. And in that 10 minutes of time, they don't pick up a drink. Then it was worth writing in the first place. And that's why I did it. Plus, there's a lot of stories in there from the Trump 2020 campaign, and those might be entertaining to some folks as well.
Tim, I love this story. In fact, I'll tell a little story. I was preparing a pitch to Donald Trump and to NBC for a show I had working title, The Apprentice Second Chance, which would be a collection of people like yourself that had run into some hard times, that had been working hard to rebuild their lives and just needed another chance, another opportunity to succeed, a hand up instead of a hand out, if you will. And then he goes and he comes down the escalator, and that was the end of that. But yeah. But it's a great, I can't wait to read this book because I love those stories of people overcoming adversity, sometimes self-imposed, and rebuilding their lives and going on to become incredibly productive members of society as you are. There's hope for all of us in stories like that, Tim.
Well, thank you for saying so. And I think there is. I mean, I think I'm proof that it really, I don't know if it's never too late, because I think for some people, you know, I was headed towards lengthy time in jail or death if I didn't get it turned around. And if I had not gotten it turned around, I would either be in jail or dead today. There's no question. But as it is, one day I woke up in jail in Fairfax County, Virginia. It was May 16th, 2015. And I knew right at that moment that it was not the first time I had been in jail. I was on probation at that time for my second of two DUIs. And if I didn't get it turned around right then, I was going to go to jail for about 3 months and it would have been the end of everything. And I would not have stopped drinking. I know that, because I would have been just at my wit's end and I would have ended up in permanent jail or death. But I woke up that morning and I knew I had to get it turned around. And less than 4 years later, I was flying on Air Force One with President Trump. So it really, truly never is late. And when I went to work for the president 4 years later, 4 years after I took my last drink, I had to tell him about my background, because anybody who looked up my police record in about 10 minutes, they would see that I had those two DUIs. I had a bunch of other alcohol-related arrests, drunk in public, that kind of stuff. So I had to be upfront with them before I got hired and said, look, somebody's going to find this if they look. And sure enough, people did look. When I got hired, but the president said he likes a good comeback story. He blames alcohol for the death of his brother. So he's right. Very much in tune with what this can do to people and families and all that. And he liked a good comeback story. And he said, go ahead, let's give it a shot. And he stood by me. Reporters did come calling, asking about my background, and the president and the campaign stood behind me. And for that, I will forever be grateful. This isn't one of those bash Trump books that are kind of popular in this era. Working for President Trump is the proudest achievement of my professional life.
So what happened after you woke up in that Fairfax jail? Like, was there a final treatment center that worked, or did you, like, a lot of people say they have to find a purpose in order to sort of make it over that hump and get beyond. Did you find a purpose, and what was it? I mean, I think we're seeing the manifestation of it here, but how would you describe it in our last couple minutes?
The easiest way to describe it is just fear, just abject fear. I woke up, and as I said, I was on probation for the second of my two DUIs. I had been sentenced to 90 days in jail for that second DUI. I had served 10. But I had 80 days suspended hanging over my head. And if I got in trouble during 3 years of probation, I was going to go serve that 80 days. Well, getting arrested for drunk in public counts as getting in trouble. And I would have violated parole and gone to probation if I had been convicted of that drunk in public. I got great advice from a lawyer, and he said, here's what you got to do before you go to court. So I did it all. I went and had the ignition interlock device put back on my car voluntarily. I went to a ton of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I went and did about 100 hours of volunteer service in an animal shelter. And I went to an outpatient rehabilitation clinic for alcohol. And I went to court and I said, my lawyer and I said, listen, we don't intend, this guy's never going to come back into your courtroom if you don't prosecute this case. And he said, all right, I'll give you this one chance. I'm not going to prosecute this drunk in public. You're not going to violate probation. But if I ever see you back in here again, I'm going to throw the book at you. And I never looked back. I never went back. And that's my sober date, May 16th, 2015. And so for me, what did it was facing the ruination of everything. I would have gone to serve 80 days in jail. It's basically 3 months. I would have lost my job, and forget about a job. I would have lost my career. I would have lost my brand new wife. My friends and family were about at their wit's end. going to jail for 3 months for me seemed like an eternity. For other people, maybe that's not so much. For other people, serving one day in jail is way too much to even consider. But for me, 80 days was just unfathomable, and that's what scared me out of it.
Well, wow. Tim, happy anniversary.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy anniversary. Definitely.
Thanks very much. Coming up on nine years.
Yeah, amazing. And thank you for sharing your story with us here and in this wonderful book. It's called Swing Hard, In Case You Hit It, My Escape from Addiction and a Shot at Redemption on the Trump Campaign. I mean, how cool is that? A personal story where the context is written, you know, leading to and around the Trump campaign in these times. I mean, that's really an amazing story. You can find that at Amazon and all good booksellers, and you can find some of Tim's work at thewashingtontimes.com, of course. Tim, we'll look forward to having you back on again. Any other places you want to shout out, websites, social media, anything like that?
Well, I would encourage people to listen to us on our great podcast that I do with a couple of other Trump alums, Hogan Gidley and Sonny Joy Nelson. It's called The Line Drive Podcast, and you can find that on Rumble and on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you find your podcasts. And the book, Swing Hard In Case You Hit It, is available, as you said, on Amazon.com, Target. I was just in a Barnes & Noble in Fairfax, Virginia, and there it was on the shelves. And so that's crazy to walk into a bookstore and see your own name and face on a book, but that happened to me today. It could happen to anybody. But I would appreciate it if folks went and checked it out. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
Absolutely. And thanks for coming and visiting us to tell us all about it. We'll be, I know Timothy and I will be getting copies and looking forward to speaking with you again real soon.
Awesome. I would appreciate that. Thanks, guys.
All right. That's Tim Murtaugh, everybody. Check out the book, Swing Hard In Case You Hit It. This is State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Plug in.
Website?
TNTradio.live.
Check it out.
Today's News Talk Radio.
It's the coolest.
TNT.
Rejoining State of the Nation is our legal expert on all things Lawfare, Gerard Folletti of Senior Counsel of the Lawfare Project. You can find out more at thelawfareproject.org. Welcome back to the State of the Nation, Gerard.
Well, thank you for having me.
The last 24 hours with Judge Marchand in New York, have you ever in your life even imagined that things like this could go on in a courtroom, denying a defendant the ability to go to his son's high school graduation, keeping jurors that are clearly biased on the jury? What's going on down there in Lower Manhattan?
Well, I think the judge wants to make sure that the perception of Donald Trump is that he's already convicted of something instead of it presumed innocent until DA Alvin Bragg actually proves something. And so he is denying him a lot of very basic requests that other defendants don't have a problem getting. Going to your son's high school graduation, that should be a no-brainer. Going to a Supreme Court argument in another case that you're involved with, that shouldn't be an issue. Now, the other part of this is, of course, he's being prevented from going on the campaign trail, but that's a whole separate issue.
Mm-hmm. So help me understand this, Gerard. I mean, what does it mean that they're preventing him from doing that? Does that just mean he would have to travel more than he would be able to be available to be in court? Is he in court every day? I mean, I'm not even understanding how this happens.
In New York City, when you are charged with a felony, you have to be present for every court hearing, which in Trump's case is Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. So you don't even get a long weekend. 4 days a week when you have to be in court, barring a medical situation or some other exigency. Now, can Trump go and have an event, a rally somewhere Monday night and fly back into court on Tuesday? Absolutely. But how realistic is that? How likely is it that someone will not be exhausted and drained by maintaining that kind of a schedule? So really, he is stuck having to show up to court 4 days a week with Wednesdays off until the trial is over.
See, now you've just said the magic words, because that was my initial analysis of this entire proceeding, is that it is designed to fatigue him both mentally and physically and emotionally. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to break his spirit. And I don't see it happening. I know for myself, the decision I would take, you want to threaten me with criminal contempt that I will immediately appeal? I'm going to my son's high school graduation. It'll be interesting to see what the president does.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And we can't predict it. I mean, Donald Trump is a maverick, and he may very well risk that, as he has made statements in the past that perhaps violated the gag order, but he has nevertheless done it, asserting his First Amendment rights. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And the other part of it is, you're also right, this is what the essence of lawfare is to bring charges, to file a lawsuit, to tie down your opponent so that they are drained, exhausted, financially damaged from paying lawyers, and unable to continue with the activities that they were engaged in before. It's making normal life a distant memory and making this the new normal.
So does he really sit in the courtroom 4 days a week? I mean, is that really what his calendar looks like right now? I guess this is still sinking in for me. He's got like all these other cases going too. How does he get to the other cases?
Well, that's the thing, he doesn't. And that's why it's always been an issue as to which case goes first and when they get scheduled, because courts are realistic that you can only have one criminal case at a time. And this happens in other cases too, when there are, you know, multiple states interested in trying someone. But yes, he has to sit there in the courtroom 4 days a week. And I will say this, I don't blame him. If it's true that he dozed off, I don't blame him, because sitting through the first 3 hours when the judge and the lawyers are talking about procedural things, I'd fall asleep, and I'm lawyer.
Let's get down to the substance of this. This whole case reeks. First of all, in New York, they're still working through the COVID backlog. They're taking criminal cases from 2021 and 2022 in New York State. The first priority goes for criminal defendants in pretrial detention. They're in jail awaiting trial. They get to go first. And then you have violent criminal defendants that are out on release. They go next. White collar crime isn't being prosecuted at all right now. And yet this case goes to the head of the line.
I'll give you one better. I had a client that was physically attacked in a hate crime, and DA Alvin Bragg didn't want to do anything for months at a time. So we took it to the feds to prosecute, because there's that backlog even in hate crimes. So, you know, it's you don't know what the DA is doing other than selecting targets for prosecution. And here he's fixated on Donald Trump, and he's pulling out all the stops to make sure that he goes to trial first and gets that conviction, because it's an important notch on Bragg's belt.
You know, Timothy mentioned the juror. We're now seeing evidence that a juror is sort of maybe got some form of Trump derangement syndrome, or, you know, on social media saying negative things. I mean, isn't that sort of a classic disqualification for a juror? I mean, is this normal? I mean, what happened?
It should be. I have to admit, I haven't seen that particular item yet. I was still getting over the fact that the four-person the jury reads both the New York Times and the Daily Mail, which is like saying you're sitting to dinner with a glass of red wine and a glass of white wine and sipping from both at the same time. So I just don't buy it. Sorry. But if that is true, that this person is making social media comments, that is definitely disqualifying. And I'm sure we'll see a motion to strike him soon.
Well, what happened is Judge Marchand denied a peremptory or a challenge for cause, which would require them to use one of the peremptory challenges. And it's just, I think, an indication of what's about to happen over the next few days, because they only were able to seat six jurors today.
Well, I think we'll see things go much quicker. Both sides have used six of their 10 peremptories, so we're past the halfway point. And unless they're making good arguments for cause, we will see a jury seated by the end of the week, probably.
Right. But it's Tuesday. So, yeah, we're in for a few days of this clown show.
But that also shows you, I think, that the judge is speeding things along even at this stage, because when you have issues of this magnitude, you want to take the time to make sure that your jurors are unimpeachable, that you're not going to have an appeal that throws everything out and you have to start from scratch because someone lied or they misstated something or you didn't ask a very simple question you should have.
Well, you know, we got an election coming up. Got to go as fast as possible. And we're going to take some incoming headlines and come as back as fast as possible because there are other Lawfare cases to discuss with Gerard Folletti right here on State of the Nation on today's News Talk, TNT.
What station is this?
News station. Ladies and gentlemen,
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The U.S. House of Representatives has officially submitted two counts of impeachment against Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate, initiating a trial set to begin on April 17th. The FBI has initiated a criminal investigation into the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. Ukrainians are becoming increasingly disillusioned with the United States due to perceived discrepancies in support compared to that provided to Israel during recent conflicts, as reported by the Wall Street Journal.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Gerard, the malevolent malefactor, Special Counsel Jack Smith, had a bad day today. And you know it was a bad day because he said he had a great day. But the Supreme Court took a highly skeptical view toward expanding Sarbanes-Oxley to cover the January 6th prosecutions. And if the court rules against that expansion, out go two of the four felony charges with which Smith has charged Donald Trump.
I'm not surprised that the Supreme Court took a skeptical view. Jack Smith, arguments are... Well, they're in line with what prosecutors have been doing for nearly two decades now, which is overreaching with the SAR box to get criminal defendants from cases that might actually not be crimes. But you use that language, you make it broad enough, and you try to apply it for things outside of, for example, destroying records, business records. And what happens is you get people convicted of something that you probably couldn't get them on anything else. And in large part, we've seen people convicted under SARBOX, under those provisions, who were very unseemly. We all knew that they were doing bad things because we could follow their company in the news for months and years. But to extend this to political figures or to people charged with essentially going into the Capitol building when they were not allowed to, that's overreach. The Supreme Court, I think, is seeing that.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing to do with documents or destroy. I mean, I'm just learning about this today, and I was doing some reading on it, and I'm like, well, wait a minute, how does this even apply? So, you know, it was kind of enlightening to realize that they're just focusing on this, you know, minute point in a larger context. And one of the justices said, "We are textualists," which I thought was a pretty interesting way to say that. I mean, so what does he mean when he says, we're textualists here? I assume that's meaning that they look at larger context of legal decisions. Am I understanding that correctly?
Two things. One is that they're looking at the actual text of a statute or law, looking at what it says, what what it's meant to do by the language that's used in it. Then you go back and look at the congressional intent, the intent behind it, because that's sometimes laid out by Congress. And that gives you the context for that specific text. That's basically where that analysis starts and stops. It's what was the intent and what does the language actually say? Not how has it been applied or misapplied by other people, and what effect does it have for other types of people if we now change our interpretation of it?
And so, I couldn't help but chuckle as Justice Gorsuch kind of tipped his hand as to how he might vote when he asked, among other things, whether pulling a fire alarm before a vote would qualify for 20 years in prison, which was a clear shot at Democrat Representative Jamal Bowman. But there's a connection here. Sarbanes-Oxley was used, and it came about after Enron, that massive accounting failure, which ended up taking down Arthur Andersen, the Big Five accounting firm. And Andrew Weissman was the overzealous prosecutor there. All charges were dismissed on appeal. And Weissman went on to serve as Robert Mueller's right-hand hatchet man in the Russiagate investigation. And now we have Jack Smith. Is there a mechanism in our legal system to rein in people like Andrew Weissman and Jack Smith?
The only real mechanism is when courts say over and over again that their ideas are BS, that they're without merit. They keep bringing charges that are dismissed, whether at trial or on appeal. That's really the only check there is, because what we are seeing, and this has always been the case in the legal profession, you have someone who comes up with this novel theory on how to prosecute someone or sue someone, and then they make the rounds. For years after that, that theory keeps going, even when it's rejected a few times, until it's been completely discredited, which is what the Supreme Court may very well end up doing here. These people keep developing their niche expertise as having this unique idea on how to get someone.
Don't tell me we've got a law review article in the offing.
Well, that's, you know what the law review article would be? If you are a lawyer and your son scribbles on, your toddler scribbles on evidence whether he can be prosecuted under Sarbanes-Oxley. And I think if you had Jack Smith, the answer would be send him to jail for 20 years.
Wow. So what happens? Like, obviously, Trump has had some gag orders, yet he still goes on Truth Social and makes comments. I've seen some prosecutors saying, you know, they want him to be fined $3,000 for social media posts and stuff. Like, what is he in any danger of being like arrested or anything other than fines if he does go to Barron's graduation or continues to, you know, make his posts on Truth Social under gag orders? Or like, what's the ramification of him breaking some of these stipulations?
I'm not going to say that there's an official three strike rule, but essentially the first few times you're found in contempt, it's a fine that increases in value. And when you do it enough time, the judge gets upset that you're not listening and throws you in jail for a few hours or maybe overnight until you learn your lesson and promise not to do it again. I don't think that that's what's going to happen with Donald Trump, because here we also have a very unique situation. It's not your average criminal defendant. It's the major candidate of a major political party running for office. And to say that he is restricted from saying things that he normally would in his pursuit of that office, that has unprecedented First Amendment challenges to it. And I don't think any of the judges so far want to be the one that pulls that trigger.
Well, 80, 90 years ago, James Michael Curley in Boston ran for Congress from jail and won. I think even Judge Marchand is smart enough to realize that if he does put Donald Trump in jail, even if it's only for a few hours, he'll basically create a martyr and increase his popularity all the more. Every indictment has increased his popularity. I think if they put Trump in jail for criminal contempt, the sky's the limit in terms of the poll numbers.
Well, I think you're right about that. You'd see a massive jump in his approval, massive jump in his polling. But more than that, I think it would actually turn off a lot of Americans to what's going on, to this prosecution.
Yeah.
Because we're starting to look like a country in the Middle East or in Africa or South America, where you jail your opponents. I mean, not even European countries do that too much these days. But we're following down that banana republic path, and people see that. And I think intuitively, even if they hate Donald Trump, You get resistance, you get pullback from a lot of Democrats I speak to. I hate Trump. I don't want ever to see him as president. I'll vote for anyone but him. But putting him in jail is a step too far. So I think that if you jail him for contempt for making a statement or going to his son's graduation, that would really show these prosecutions for what they are.
Yeah.
And I mean, we saw the bond he just had to pay recently. So I'm assuming, you know, a $3,000 slap on the wrist here or there and a threat of a few hours in jail might not deter him. Do you think he's going to go to Barron's graduation in defiance of the court?
I think he may very well do that, to be honest. I think that I also think that it's possible a judge will change his mind because this doesn't look good for a judge. What, you can't take a day off for your son's graduate? You're going to punish a boy who's graduating high school because you couldn't be flexible with your schedule? That, I don't think the judge will really keep it at that level.
Well,
Gerard Ferlitti, we've got about a minute left. People can go to the lawfareproject.org for information. What else do they need to know? Social media, where else can they find you?
Social media, and that's about it, to be honest. I mean, I like being with you guys, so if people want to hear me speak, then they should watch and listen to TNT Radio, because this is where they got their information that's actually accurate, and you know, we see what the situation really is.
Well, we like that idea, and we like having you on. Can't wait to have you back, Gerard Felitti. Thanks so much for your time and sharing your expertise.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Stay tuned after these headlines. We have more State of the Nation right here on today's News Talk, TNT.
I was a quarterback at Hardaway High School. College first round draft pick, on and off the field. We were taught to not show any signs of weakness. During the football season, I would stop eating. But I didn't know I was depressed. I thought that something was wrong with me. For 20 plus years, was physical, physical, physical. We didn't have any education behind what mental health was. I started to learn it starts here first. If this is together, I'll be better as a father, as a man, and as a husband. Put the importance on your mental health. I'm not scared to talk about it anymore. The first tool is therapy. The second one is positive self-talk. And then journaling, putting your thoughts on paper. We have to redefine what being a strong man is and heal, love your mind.
Hi, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
See, Smokey thinks I'm funny.
Critically analyzing national affairs.
This is State of the Nation
with Timothy Shea and Brian McLean on today's News Talk.
TNT.
TNT.
All right. Our next guest says Bidenflation isn't going away, as this week the U.S. Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics announced that the Consumer Price Index, that CPI we keep talking about, rose 3.5% in March from a year earlier. This measure of inflation was higher than many expected. And joining us now to discuss is Project 21 Ambassador Mike Hill from National Center for Public Policy. Mike, welcome to State of the Nation. You know, we just had Gene Valentino on in the previous hour, and he brought up the CPI, and he had a whole list of Bidenflation things, and it was really scary to look at what things cost back in like 2019, 2020, versus now we're seeing anywhere from 33 to 65% increases on normal things that we all get at the grocery store. I think the mean average was 45% increase. What's going on here?
Well, what we see going on is an out of control, both monetary and fiscal policy. Now, monetary policy is, of course, controlled by the feds. And fiscal policy is what happens with the legislative and executive branches. So what the feds do is, we know, they try to control inflation by adjusting the rate that they charge their member banks. And by doing that, those banks are forced to either increase or decrease what they charge to loan money, particularly for credit cards, mortgages, cars, and so forth. Now, on the fiscal side, that's where the legislative and executive branch come in, where they will control, or they will dictate what happens with our economy through taxes and spending. And we all know right now that spending is out of control. Our federal deficit is over $34 trillion and has just gone out of sight since Biden has been in office. So when you have that kind of deficit creation and then government spending, It causes inflation. Inflation is caused by too many dollars chasing too few goods. And as you mentioned at the beginning, we are all feeling it every time we go to purchase just about anything.
Mike, I just got a message from Don in San Diego. Social Security benefits are on pace for a 2.6 cost of living adjustment in 2025. Rather than continuing to decelerate, consumer prices are once again building steam. Specifically, the CPIW increased 2.9% in January, 3.1% in February, and 3.5% in March, the highest reading in 7 months. What are we doing to our seniors with these economic policies?
Oh, we're hurting them because, you know, they're pretty much on a fixed income. You know, when we see these cost of living adjustments of 2.9% or whatever, it's not enough to even keep up with inflation. And so when they go to buy groceries, clothing, the staples just to continue living, they can't keep up. And so it is hurting them dramatically. And because they feel that, this is going to hurt the Biden administration and Joe Biden when he comes up for his election, because the primary voters are the elderly, those who are 45 and above, and of course our retirees. They vote. Now, we know that right now Joe Biden is trying to buy the young vote by spending insane amounts of money to remove their student loan debt. But and he hopes that by doing that, they'll go out and vote for him. Statistically, people in that age group, younger people, don't vote at the same level as those who are older. And so we find those who are on Social Security, they are feeling this sting of inflation more sharply. And I think it's going to spell bad news for Biden when it comes election time.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point there. You know, I was looking at a report earlier this week, and they were talking about increases in property tax. And, you know, state to state, there's a number of states where this is happening. I'm in Texas, and they're very high here. Came from California, where everything else was really high. So I don't know, maybe it evens out at some point. But When I see a retired person, you know, wondering if they're going to be able to stay retired, even though they own their home, because the taxes have gone, you know, property tax has gone up, then you throw this on top of it, and cost of energy, you know, everything's going up. What I mean, this seems like a big blunder for the Biden campaign. I mean, we've seen gas going up to $5 again pretty soon here too, probably. So it's a huge blunder. Why do you think they're so focused on, you know, the somewhat radicalized youth and people that, you know, young people that are in college debt? Do they really think that's a winning strategy?
Well, I think the reason why they think that that is a winning strategy for them is because people who are just leaving college are the most indoctrinated with the leftist ideology. So they haven't been in the workforce long enough to know that that leftist ideology of Marxism, communism, doesn't work. It doesn't work. So they have just left the academic arena where it's been driven into them for four or more years that communism is the way to go, and they tend to believe it. And so Biden is hoping that these young people will believe it, because when you look at removing their student debt and spreading it out to all taxpayers, that is what communism is. And so in their mind, they're thinking, well, yeah, this does work. No, it doesn't work. And the rest of the economy is feeling it, because when they spend that kind of money, again, all those dollars chasing a limited amount of goods, it causes prices to go up. It's a basic economic law of supply and demand. And so as prices go up and these young people now get out into the workforce, they're finding that they're unable to afford a mortgage because those interest rates driven by inflation have gone up to high levels. And so they're forced to rent. And now because there are more renting instead of buying against supply and demand, it causes the rent structures to increase, rent prices, because there's this demand for renting now. And I can tell you, I'm looking at this firsthand. I have three adult children. One owns his home, thank goodness. I have two who wanted to buy a home this year and could not because of the high interest rates that they're seeing for mortgage rates. And so they are now renting, and the rent amount is almost equivalent to what a mortgage would have been before these mortgage rates went up so high.
And I'm sure it's completely coincidental that most of the single family home transactions are going to companies like BlackRock that are then turning around and renting them out, trying to turn us into a nation of renters where you'll own nothing and like it, right? And forget about a mortgage. There was a video a couple weeks ago where a young woman just graduated from college flipped out when she realized that working an hour at the job she has wouldn't even pay for a packet of chicken. She couldn't buy three chicken breasts in a pack at the supermarket with what she takes home in and out for an hour's worth of work.
Exactly. And you raise such a good point, Tim, because I just mentioned my two adult children who are looking to rent. They were finding a tough time with apartment rentals. I'm in Florida. The Panhandle of Florida, apartment rental rates were jumping at every single renewal. Every year they were going up. So what did they find they were able to rent? They found this community of homes. There must be, I'll guess and say, 150 homes in this community, all rental homes. So this is property that, as you say, BlackRock, they go in, build these homes or buy these homes, and then use them for rental property. And so my children have been forced to go in and rent these homes with the hopes that inflation is going to go down when we have a new president, and then mortgage rates will go down, and then they'll be able to buy. But right now, they are renting in a community of homes that are all rental homes.
Are they tiny homes? That's the other thing we keep seeing, is this whole push towards living in a van. It used to be a joke to live in a van down by the river, you know, Chris Farley. But now we've got, like, you know, micro homes, tiny homes, shipping container homes. In San Francisco, they even put a number of those up right off the Embarcadero. It was such a strange thing to see.
Well, actually, they're not that tiny, but you're looking at 2,500 square feet, decent size home. But what they're paying for it is what you would have paid for a mortgage just a few years ago. But instead, they're renting and not owning it right now. You know, and they're, I won't call them block homes, but they're all built exactly the same. They have the same floor design and layout. Nice homes. But again, you are paying a rental amount that just a few years ago would have been a mortgage payment, so you could start building up equity in that home. They're not doing that now.
Yeah, not building up equity, not being able to save because the rents are so high now, that not being able to save for that down payment so that they can get into the vehicle that was traditionally the fast lane to the American dream. Maybe we need Jimmy McMillan back with the rent is too damn high party.
Right. Or all we need to do is get Congress to stop spending so much money. I mean, they just passed the bill, you know, was it a month or two ago, of $34 trillion and money going to Ukraine, money that is funding these illegal immigrants who are coming in. And by the way, you know, you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it says that over 300,000 jobs have been created within the past month. What they don't tell you is those are part-time jobs, And the majority of those are going to illegal immigrants. Illegal immigrants and government jobs. They are not going to private sector full-time employment jobs. And so we have, again, government spending this money to take care of illegals, to take care of a border in Ukraine, but not the border, our northern and southern border, not taking care of that. Fighting these wars when instead the energy sector, they are not allowing on federal lands to produce the oil and gas that is necessary to fuel our economy. So now we're seeing gas prices per gallon, $3.50 and higher and climbing. When you might recall just 3 years ago, it was close to around $2.25, at least here in the panhandle of Florida. So all of this is being created by a fiscal and monetary policy, which is out of control. We must rein it in.
And isn't Mike, it curious that they... Oh, go ahead, Hesh.
Just a simple question. Are they trying to destroy our society? Are they trying to bankrupt America? Because you look at the debt and you compare it to GDP, and it's just, it's like, this is madness. This is a suicide mission, and anyone should be able to see it, especially, you know, people at the Fed and people in Congress.
They do see it. But what I think is going on is that, one, it is a march towards communism. It's a march towards one world government. And part of that is to, if you use the communist plank, it is to come in, disrupt what is there, take it down, and then come back with what they say is something better. You know, like Biden's Build Back Better. So it's that is the Marxist communist plank, is to tear it down, destroy it, and then we're going to be the saviors of the world, and we're going to put in a better position, a better system to run it. They are so arrogant. Yes, I'm sorry. I was going to say they are so arrogant that they can't recognize it has never worked with any country anywhere since its inception. But they are so arrogant to think that we can do it right this time. We're going to do it right.
Yeah, they didn't use those other failed regimes, didn't use true communism. We're going to use true communism. That's right. The line I like best is that capitalism is the unequal distribution of prosperity and communism is the equal distribution of misery. And isn't it curious that energy and food, two items you just mentioned, are not included in the CPIW, the Consumer Price Index for wages and whatnot, but yet they do include government jobs in the jobs numbers. Maybe if we're going to play fast and loose with numbers, maybe we need jobs numbers that don't include government jobs.
Exactly. And that consumer price index, as you say, it's made up of a basket of goods that does not include the most volatile commodities, fuel and food. And so they pull that out. So it's not giving us even a true picture of what the inflation is. They're saying at 3.5%, but we all know it's much higher than that. In some areas, we're seeing the cost of new cars have gone up 22%. We're seeing the cost of food skyrocketing. As you had mentioned, an hour's worth of labor would not buy a meal for this young lady to go to the grocery store and purchase a chicken to eat. And so what we need to do is be more transparent with the numbers. And by the way, the feds have set this arbitrary rate of 2% as a target rate for inflation. What a lot of people don't understand is before the feds came along in 1914, inflation was pretty much unheard of. Inflation, when it did happen, it was very short term, or during a time of war or some other catastrophe. But it was not this long-term steady, even 2% target rate. It was not there until the feds came along. And by the way, throughout this entire scenario, you mentioned those who are being hurt the most, our seniors and those who are do not have a lot of income. But those who are very wealthy, including the banks, the feds, the private banks, they are doing very well.
Yeah, of course they are. Of course they are. They seem to come out on top no matter which direction the arrow is going on the graph. Mike, we're out of time. This has been Mike Hill with us. Mike, people can find your work, of course, at nationalcenter.org. Anywhere else you'd like to shout out before we got to let you go? You got 20 seconds.
They can email me at mikehillconservative@gmail.com. mikehillconservative@gmail.com, and I will respond.
All right. Excellent. Thank you for putting that out there. And thank you for joining us here and sharing your expertise with us. Mike Hill, it's been a pleasure. We'll look forward to your next appearance. So stay tuned. Thank you for watching State of the Nation here at Today's News Talk. Stay tuned for the Jason Burmis Show.